Tonight on Arena, legendary soul singer Candy Staton on her new album Back to My Roots and director Matty Fleifel on his new film To a Land Unknown. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Legendary singer Candy Staton started as an 11-year-old gospel prodigy travelling across America alongside Mahalia Jackson and Sam Cooke before making her mark in soul music at the iconic Muscle Shoals. By the mid-70s, she'd crossed over into disco with Young Hearts Run Free, a song that became an anthem for people seeking freedom from toxic relationships, written, as it turns out, about Candy's own abusive marriage. When the dance floors faded, she found a second life in gospel music, only to be pulled back into the spotlight decades later when You Got the Love became an international dance sensation. Candy Staton is back with a new album called Back to My Roots, and it seems after more than seven decades in music, she still isn't ready to slow down, and it is an absolute privilege and a delight to have Candy Staton speak with us on Arena this evening. Candy, you're most welcome, and thank you so much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean.
Listen, this album of yours, when I saw this title, Back to My Roots, I wondered, how is Candy Staton going to go back to her roots? How is she going to go about that? And you really do bring us back, I think, to the songs of your childhood, particularly the gospel music of your childhood in your family home. How big a thing was it in the Staton household, gospel music and Christianity?
I was big. My mother was a devout Christian woman of God, and she read us the Bible. We didn't have street lights and anything like that. Born and raised in Alabama, I stayed there until I was 11, went to Cleveland. That's when I got with the Jewel Trip. But every evening she would sit there on the porch and she would read us the Bible, and she would make us sit and listen. And then she would make us sing It's Gonna Rain.
Well, in fact, I was going to say, not only did she make you listen to the Bible, then she said, you're finished listening now. Now get up there and sing that song. Let us listen to how you introduced that song yourself on the new album, Back to My Roots.
God sure knows about the rainbow sign. It no more water, but fire next time.
The opening couple of verses there from It's Gonna Rain from Back to My Roots. And I can hear you laughing, Candy Staton, as you listen to it. That singing that with your sister Maggie's on that track with you.
Yeah, she's got the next verse.
singing that with her and with the choir in behind you there, it must have just woken up memories of childhood. I presume
it did.
Lots of them,
yes,
very happy.
It did. And it reminds me so much of her. I mean, she passed away in 1979. And that was her favorite, her favorite song. And that's one of my roots right there.
Was it an important lesson to learn, you know, because obviously she's the reference there is the biblical reference to Noah's Ark. And yeah, next time it's going to be fire, which we might all find out about in time. But was it a good lesson to be carrying around with you? It's Gonna Rain, you know, to kind of...
It was a warning. It's actually a warning, you know, to tell people to get right with God, you know, because it's going to rain. The first time it rained, it was in Noah's time, you know, it rained in the ark and all that stuff. But the next time it said it would be fire. So that means something altogether different. But she wanted, I just kept it in mind, and I decided that we should do it on this Back to My Roots, because that is the roots.
Yeah, and
the beginning of the roots.
Yeah, you really can hear that. You mentioned the Jewel Gospel Trio earlier on. I mean, you were 11 or 12, I think, when you first, you went off to school, and it was a Christian school, the Jewel, the Jewel Academy, or the Jewel Gospel Christian Academy, I think was the correct title.
It was a Jewel Academy. We were the Jewel Gospel Trio. We were like offsprings of the school. We were there to help other kids, less fortunate kids. We never made any money much, you know, but we met a lot of great people that helped to carry me to where I am today. That was just stepping stones. Yeah. And we did that with Naomi Harris, and she was 9. I was 11. My sister was 13. And we all used to sing with Sam Cooke, where everybody would be on the show, and oh, the tickets would be like $2. Auditoriums would be filled to the brim. We were the only gospel group that had a band.
Wow.
Back in the day when we were in the 50s, no gospel group ever had a band. And we had a 5-piece band, the drums, the bass, the gospel steel, keyboards, and rhythm guitar. And three little girls singing their hearts out on stage. And we were a phenomenon. We were nobody could we had to end every show. In every show, we had to end it because they couldn't come behind us.
Wow.
Everybody else had like a guitar, organ, piano, but we had the big band.
Yeah. And had you any sense? I mean, that would have been around the time of the Mahalia Jackson stuff as well. You and Sam mm-hmm. Cooke, as you mentioned, had you any sense as a young girl that you were with these legends of gospel and of soul music?
I used to admire them. We had a little radio. We had a little old, my daddy went out and found us a little radio, and we used to hear it on the gospel radio stations, and I adored these people. I wanted to be like these people. I would sing behind them, and I would sing behind Mahalia, and I would try to mock Mahalia as she sung songs, and we would learn it, and we were just into it. And to meet them in person and become family with them was just beyond my wildest imagination. And I remember the first time I met Mahalia, I was peeking through a peephole in her dressing room. We were at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, Tennessee. And she said, her keyboard player, tapped me on the shoulder. I was a little girl. She said, "Do you want to meet her?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she opened the door, and Mahalia hugged me, and I thought I had just died and gone to heaven. Mahalia Jackson just hugged me. I heard about you. I'm going to watch you. And she said, "One of these days, I'm going to get me some of that music."
Well, she certainly did that. And thankfully, as you say, was one of the stepping stones which brought you to other places within your career as well.
Yes.
That did finish up. You went back to Alabama. And it was a kind of change in the style of music. When you found yourself kind of being set up to sing the song "Young Hearts Run Free," did you feel you were in the same musical room as your gospel music, or did it feel as if you'd gone to a totally different planet?
Well, when you go to church and they tell you if you sing the blues, you're going to hell. So I had to work my way through that area to convince myself, no, I'm not going to hell. This is life. I named it life music. I told Al Green one time, he said, "What's wrong with my songs? They're not, I'm tired of being alone." That's the truth. I said, "Well, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life." So it's life music.
Yep.
So you're not going nowhere. You're going wherever your heart goes. So I said, "No, we're not going to be guilty of that anymore." And that's what I really just let it all hang out.
Yeah. And
so I'm going to sing whatever I want to sing.
Yeah. And "Young Hearts Run Free" was one of the huge hits, the kind of big disco style hit, as we'll hear now in a moment. And we'll hear the story of how this actually fitted into, unfortunately, what was happening in your own life at the time. But let's have a listen to the song first. "Young Hearts Run Free" from Candy Sitton, who's with me on the programme this evening, talking about her new album, "Back to My Roots." "Young Hearts Run Free" is not on that album. But, you know, it's such an upbeat song, that, Candy. But when you listen to the lyrics of, particularly in
it's
the chorus.
Sad.
Yeah. And it was a sad time in your life.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It was I was in with this. I even hate to go back there. It's so dark, you know. But I was with this guy, and he was threatening to kill everybody in my family if I left him, because he was pimping me. And so, I was telling David Crawford, we were doing the first album with Warner Brothers. I had just left Fame Records at the time. Warner Brothers was looking for a producer, and I had just signed with them. And I had known David for many years, because he was with the Caravans in the gospel industry. So we had talked about getting together and doing some music together. But to make a long story short, we would be sitting down. We've done some of the sides for the album. But we were sitting down eating lunch, and we would go to lunch quite often. And I would tell him what I was going through. I was just dumping. I was just, you know, listening to somebody just in an open ear. I wanted to tell somebody what I was going through because you can't talk to everybody. And so I told David, and I realized he was writing. He just kept writing down stuff, and he would look up at me and he would write it down. We would eat and he would look up at me and I would keep talking and we would write it down. And he took that song, the words that I was saying to him, and made a song out of them. Yeah. And it came out, Young Heart Run Free.
And when you were singing that song at that time, did it help you pluck up the courage to do what you had to do, which was to get out of that relationship and move on with your life? Did singing the song actually feed into that?
Oh, yes. Yes, it gave me courage. You know, I was with him at the time. And I would listen to it myself. And I said, I got to get rid of this man. I don't know how I'm going to do it. And nobody's going to get hurt. And I just figured out a way to get rid of him.
You did it.
I moved back to my mother's home I went back to my roots.
Well, exactly as you have done
I
here.
I left Virginia, where I was living, Reston, Virginia, and I built a house next to my mother's house, which I went back to my roots to get rid of him. And that's what got rid of him.
And I want to go back to the album that we're speaking about, Back to My Roots. I'm just going to go into this song, your own song, 1963, very quickly. People will know what this is about. It was one of the songs on the album, Candy, I Have to Be Frank, that stopped me in my tracks as I listened to it. The simple power of it.
Oh my God, people running, people screaming, people cursing, people crying, trying to get to safety. With the help of God on our side, we prayed all the way through. We made it through the crowd unharmed. My two little boys were with me. I was 23 on that bloody Sunday in 1963. Four little girls lost their lives. Little Cynthia West, little Carol Robinson, little Denise McNair, and little Addie Mae Collins. Between the ages of 11 and 14. They never made it that day.
I wanted to get to that point in the song.
Yes,
it's
yes,
so
yes.
Important. Cynthia Wesley, Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson,
yes.
Denise McNair, naming those four girls who were killed in that 1963 bombing of the 16th
right.
Street Baptist
yes,
Church
yes.
in
A
Alabama.
A bomb was left under the steps near the basement where they were.
How important was it when you were writing that song, the naming of the girls? Because it's so vital in that they are called
out
like that.
That's what I wanted to get out, because nobody ever called their names. They needed to know those girls gave up their lives and changed the world. People began to recognize Martin Luther King and everybody else that this is dangerous. We got to stop it. It's got to stop. Martin Luther King really got adamant about the racism during that time because we knew how dangerous it was getting. And we had to just stop it. He had to stop it any way that he could. And he got everybody together. And that's how the civil rights movement really moved forward.
When did you actually write that song? How soon after the event could you sit down and do that, Candy?
Well, it took a long time. Bill Carpenter, my publicist, I think it was the 60th anniversary of the little girl's death, and he said we need to recognize them. We need to find a song. We need to get a song together. And I pondered over it, and that whole event, the whole scene, just came down so. I could see everything so clearly in my mind. And that's how I began to write it. I began to write it and I began to tell the story. I knew I couldn't sing it, so I had to speak it. And that's how it came about. And that's how it got on the album. And do you know what, Sean? I cried all the way through.
I can imagine, because even listening to it, I found it incredibly difficult. I found it difficult to say the four girls' names. because it's such a vital thing. The calling out of the person's, person's name. I can only imagine how difficult that was to sing, as you say, 60 years on.
Yes, they would be 60. They would probably be 70 in their 70s and 80s right now. They would have, you know, it was a lot. It was really bad.
And of course, it gives us a sense of, because I've gone back a little bit, obviously, in time, but of the kind of segregated society that you grew up in and how difficult that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. It was bad. It was bad. I saw the Ku Klux Klan come by our house so many nights, you know, with their lamps and hitting lamps and all that stuff and screaming, you know, the N-word, and we're running behind the house, getting under beds, and my mother saying, be quiet, turning off, blowing out the lamps. We didn't have electric lights. I grew up with the necessity. We didn't have anything. So we still had lamp lights, and she'd blow the lights out as though nobody was home, tell us to get under the bed and hide. So it was frightening. I mean, I went through it. I don't want to go through it again.
I can imagine. Are you fearful that, you know, are we in a place where that awful hatred could boil over again? I mean, one of the the final track in the album is all about, or not this, one of the end tracks is all about a love breakthrough, where you're kind of saying, do you know, let's get rid of hatred and let's think more about love.
Yes, that's what we need more. We need more love. It's just old and it's just stagnant and it needs to stop.
Yeah. I want to finish on a lighter note, if I can, Candy. I adored the album, and I hope it's a huge success for you. I really do. And it's great that you're so in behind it and so energetic about it all, still at this point in time. But You Got the Love. This is the song that just keeps giving for you, isn't it?
Isn't that amazing?
So how did it start, and where has it gone to since?
It started as a commercial, actually. It's so strange how songs hit records are made. You can't predict a hit record. It started as Dick Gregory had out this, and I know you might have heard this story before. Yeah. But he had out this diet called the Bahamian Diet, and he was trying to get a guy that was 1,000 pounds down to 195. That was a task. And so I met him in Nassau, and he asked me, we were at a conference there, and he said, I got a song that I'd like for you to try to sing for me, but we're going to do a video. That's all it's going to be used for is a video. I said, oh, okay. He said, well, I'll bring you to Chicago, and we can do it, and we'll go from there. So he asked me, well, how much are you going to charge me? I said, well, I gave him the amount I wanted. And he said, no. I said, so my a friend of mine was there. He's like an attorney. He said, well, how about half the publishing? And that's where it stopped. And he said, okay, fine. So we signed the contract, and I did the song. It laid dormant for 10 years.
Yeah, so you
nobody
got
nobody would play it.
You signed for half the publishing rights. In the 1990s, The Source did a remix of it. It was used in what we thought was the last episode of Sex and the City. It was used there. And then Florence and the Machine came along and
came along and did it again. And it's been done, I don't know how many times. Sean, I can't keep up with it. Somebody's always doing it. I mean, and I'm like, thank you. I appreciate that. I just go to the mailbox and pick up my check.
Yeah. So maybe when your mama said, it's going to rain, maybe she knew it was going to rain a few dollars later on in life
maybe
as well.
Maybe so. Maybe that's what she meant. One of these days, honey, it's going to rain on you.
Candy, thank you so much. I'm going to finish up by going out on a little bit of You Got the Love. Thanks so much for being with us this evening for sharing your stories with us. Candy Staton. Thanks, Candy. All the best.
You too.
And we finish up with You Got the Love.
But sooner or later in life, the things you love, you'll lose. Just like before, I know I'll call on you.
There you go. You Got the Love from Candy Staton, and a very good life lesson. If you can get half the publishing rights, do that. You never know your luck further down the line. The album that Candy was speaking to us about and how wonderful it was to speak with her, the album is called Back to My Roots and it is released this Friday. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. To a Land Unknown is the debut feature film from Palestinian-Danish director Mahdi Fleifel. The film tells the story of two Palestinian men, Reda and Chatila, who are living in a state of limbo in Athens. They exist on the margins of society, surviving hand to mouth as they try to gather the money to buy passports so that they can get to Germany and start new lives. Marginalisation, addiction and other problems stifle their best intentions. But when they encounter an unaccompanied Palestinian boy, they seek to help him and in turn help themselves. To a Land Unknown opens in selected Irish cinemas this weekend and I'm delighted to be joined in studio this evening by director Mahdi Fleifel. It really struck me when I was watching the film, Mahdi, you have a background in documentary film and there is a documentary aspect to the story that you're telling here. I think it started in your mind as a documentary. How did it suddenly shift or how did it morph into the fictional story or partly fictional story that you tell?
Well, I mean, I'm trained as a fiction director. And I've always wanted to create films from my imagination, if you will, but documentary was more accessible to me. So I spent years doing that. And I followed several guys who were trying to escape life in the camps in Lebanon and Syria and come to Europe. And most of them end up being stranded in Athens. And so I made several documentary films, but with the idea that one day I'd like to do something like create a universe out of this and make a film that I miss watching. You know, I'm a child of the 80s, so the cinema that I love is Hollywood 70s, 80s cinema, and that's what I wanted to pay a homage to with this film.
Yeah, and there is a buddy aspect to this film, just to give the listener the outline. It's two cousins who are Palestinian, and we don't go into the political background of any of that part of the story. We simply see their struggles to make their way out of Athens, they hope, eventually to Germany. But it's buddy time. It's Midnight Cowboy. It's Of Mice and Men. It's that type of friends movie, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, those are the films that I grew up loving, whether it was Fredo or Michael in The Godfather or, you know, Charlie and Terry in On the Waterfront. And you picked up on Of Mice and Men. I mean, they're really modeled after George and Lenny. They had the dream of the farm. Chatila and Reda, they have the dream of opening their own cafe in Germany. And I grew up loving the going back to the 80s cinema. That's the kind of movie I loved, whether it was 48 Hours or Lethal Weapon, the series or Midnight Run. And again, it seems to be the film that I've been doing even throughout my documentary work. They were always about my friends and family, but the approach was a first person, so I was behind the camera. And it was always, you know, documenting my friend's journey. Mm. And so the buddy movie has always been just part of my story.
The two men, Reda and Chatila, what particular aspect of the Palestinian refugee story, to put a big label on, you know, these are all individual people with individual stories. But what particular aspect of that story did you feel you wanted to tell in this movie that perhaps hasn't or wasn't been told elsewhere?
I don't know. I mean, I to be honest, I don't really see this as a Palestinian story. They are Palestinian, but it's really a story of exile. You know, these guys are, how shall I put it? They're, you know, in the film I use poetry, and in particular Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, and he was really the poet of the exiles, and I think he was always talking of people who were, in a way, dreaming of nothing more than a life as simple as life itself, and this is really what Darwish would say, and so that's the story of these guys. They're they're so preoccupied with just finding this small corner where they can live, just have a simple life. And so there's not much. Of course, they're born out of the Nakba, you know, the Nakba being the Palestinian, the great trauma, the 1948 dispossession. But they're exiles, and I think that was what I wanted to explore in this film, more than a typical refugee story. I feel like we've seen so many of those over the years, and I wanted to do something a little different and focus on that state of what it means to not belong or to just want to find a place that you can call home.
And also, in the case of both the characters, Chatila played by Mahmoud Bakri and Reda played by Aram Saba, they have to at times do pretty awful things simply to get from one end of the day to the next, to have enough money to get from one end of the day to the next, to gather the money to get the passports that they need to get themselves beyond where they are. And I guess what I found myself doing watching the film was saying, what would I do in that situation before I start judging them for what they're doing here? Mm. What would you do if you were stuck in that in that limbo that they're in?
Exactly. I mean, this was my thinking throughout. I'm you know, in a way, I'm lucky in that my parents decided to leave the camp when I was 9 and I came to Europe.
Where were they? What camp were they in?
Ain al-Hilwi refugee camp in Lebanon, which is the largest Palestinian camp.
Which is referred to in the film as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I was lucky in the sense that I left, you know, my parents took me when I was 9 to Europe and I grew up in Denmark. But it always stayed with me that what happened to my friends who weren't that lucky, you know, and they later found themselves stranded in the streets of Athens and trying to, as illegal immigrants, no documents, nothing, trying to just, I don't know. I mean, for me, that was always my thinking. What would I have done if I were in their place? And so, and also, you know, when you're in a dog-eat-dog world, when you're in a jungle, what, you know, and there's no one looking after you. Again, going back to the state of exile, you don't have a nation. You don't have an army to protect you. You don't have anything.
Yeah.
So what do you do? And for me, that was what I mean. And you know, there's certainly no angels, but it's this moral complexity that I'm more interested in. And I don't know if it was, again, going back to that 70s, 80s, whether it was the early Scorsese film or De Palma, or it was always the kind of the crook or the sinner or the person with a broken soul. Those are the people that always fascinated me. And so, yeah.
So we have the two cousins. Reda certainly has an addiction problem. Chatila is the kind of the brains of the operation in some ways. But that means that he can think of nefarious ways to get around difficulties. I want to play a scene. Most of the film is obviously in Arabic, and there's probably some Greek in there as well along the way. But there are a couple of scenes in English, not least of which is one between Mahmoud Bakri as Chatila and a character called Tatiana, who is this Greek woman that he meets himself, and she is played by Angeliki Papoulia, quite a well-known actress of Yorgos Lanthimos films and the like. She would be well-known in Greece. They have come across this little boy, maybe 12 or 13-year-old guy, who's also stuck in Athens but wants to get to Italy. And Chatila comes up with a plan that he puts to Tatiana.
There is something you want to tell me, no?
Okay, Tatiana. Okay, yeah, there is something. It's not easy. There's this boy. We want to help him.
Help? What do you mean, help him?
He's only 13 years old. His mother died. His asshole father left him.
My God, how awful.
Yeah, you know what the smugglers did? He left him here in the streets. So, We want to fly him to his aunt in Italy. So they start a new life together.
A new life together. How beautiful. How you will make it happen? Tell me.
To fly him with a plane, we need someone to play like his mother. Someone from here, someone Greek. You wanted to know this is it?
I thought you will ask to stay here. or ask me for money. But this is original. Πολύ πρωτότυπο. Μπράβο.
And that's Angelica Papulia as Tatiana, and Chatila, played by Mahmoud Bakri, in the film To a Land Unknown. The writer and director, Mahdi Fleifel, with me in studio this evening. The chemistry between Mahmoud Bakri, who is an actor and comes from an acting background, and Adam Sabad, the cousin, Reda, who I believe has little or no acting background.
He'd never acted before.
He was a skater.
Yeah, he's a professional skater.
What ice skating?
Skateboarding.
All right, okay.
Yeah. The guy we wanted, he couldn't get a visa to leave, and so we were stuck about 3 weeks before production, and the sound recordist tipped us on Aram. He said, there's this skater, and we did a Zoom call with him, and then I auditioned him with Mahmoud over Zoom, and he was just brilliant, like a natural.
In terms of the film itself, I think you've spoken about this today. If you tell any story that has a Palestinian aspect to it on film, it's going to be seen as an act of resistance. Did that feed into... It's been a long time in gestation, this project. In terms of getting funding, in terms of getting the film made, how difficult did that aspect, that possible act of resistance, make the making of the film?
For me, it was just like growing up, like being in Denmark, for example. The Danish Film Institute were like, why should we give you our taxpayers money to go and make a film in Greece, in Arabic, with mostly non-actors? Why can't you come and make a film in Denmark instead? And I said, well, I don't have a story to tell in Denmark.
That's not the film I want to make.
My story is out there somewhere. It's out in Greece. And so it wasn't easy to convince people. And the other aspect was that most of them were like, well, we've seen plenty of stories about refugees. Why do we need another film about refugees? And I was like, no, this is a different take on it. And this is not, I always saw it as a, like you said, a buddy movie, but a heist film, a thriller.
Mahdi, thanks so much for coming in to us and speaking to us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
That's Mahdi Fleifel, and Mahdi's film To a Land Unknown will open in selected cinemas this coming Friday. Why are all our favourite books, films, plays or songs charged with love and heartbreak? This is the story behind a new dance theatre piece, Please Break My Heart, which plays tomorrow and Friday at Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin as part of the Seen and Heard Festival of New Work. It's the brainchild of Nora Nianlun Fay, performer and choreographer and artistic director of NAF. I presume NAF is the fun, fun acronym there, Nora. Dance Company, who is with me in studio right now. Please Break My Heart, a performance for Valentine's Night.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this, I believe, kind of started with a New Year's resolution back in 2023.
Yeah, that's it exactly. I think I always noticed that all the kind of the big stories, films, books were always kind of saturated with love and heartbreak and people using that somehow to make something in a way. So I was so like taken by that in a way that I thought, okay, well, as a maker, practically speaking, I need content for work and for pieces. I actually just need to get heartbroken. So for 2023 was my New Year's resolution to get my heart broken in a way. And I just, I'm being like pragmatic here. That's what I should do in a way. So I think that's what kind of triggered this whole mad piece.
Did you succeed in your New Year's resolution?
Yes and no. Definitely got me a lot of content anyway. So it got me material, which is all I wanted.
Yeah. So, okay. I guess as much as anything else, going out and getting your heart broken was, it's a good line into what the piece is. But there was a lot of reading around popular culture, around books, around film.
Yeah, there's so many artists, like all our favorites, either kind of from the most modern and pop kind of culture references now, up to Taylor Swift or Adele, and even back to the Elvis, or the kind of as far back as you can go in time, Shakespeare even as well, all kind of use it somehow. It seems to be this kind of universal entity or a feeling that we can all tap into in a way, and we're kind of crave in a way. Like people love listening to sad music when they're sad as well. It's going to be, you kind of yearn for it even when you're feeling it or terrified of it at the same time. So I think it's such an interesting emotion, and kind of seeing how these films or books have kind of molded what we think about love and heartbreak as well has been really fascinating, kind of to dive into all of that.
Yeah, do you think that there's an aspect that popular culture, and not just popular culture, some high culture are there,
definitely,
that there is this idea that, well, you have to experience heartbreak or you'll never know what true love is.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a real also cliche kind of in the arts as well, to like to make through pain and to have the suffering of the artist and everything to kind of make something worthwhile, or the tortured poet almost in a way of it as well. So it seems to be such a kind of endless kind of pit of inspiration somehow. But I think we kind of play with this kind of heavy or sometimes mad or traumatic topic almost, but in a kind of very comedic lens as well. So kind of using the language of kind of Naff Dance, my company, and which is kind of camp and comedic and silly and lighthearted, and kind of throwing that in with this kind of mad subject of heartbreak as well.
And also when you're talking about the dance company there and all those various qualities, it's not, it's a dance company, but this is very much a multidisciplinary show.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up kind of training in dance and theatre as well, and kind of being informed by so many different art forms as well. I think I always see a piece as a whole as well. It's always driven by dance, so that's my primary language as well. But I love infusing it with kind of text and films and music, and playing with kind of different soundtracks, how we can make it a full kind of body of work as well, and with allowing dance and contemporary dance to be what kind of drives it forwards as well.
Yeah, let's have a listen to an audio clip from the show, which will give us, it's hard to describe dance on the radio, so the audio clip will give us more of a sense of it in terms of that listening experience.
So do you always have to make an album about it? Can't you just go,
it's cheaper to write an album about it. Well, I don't pay for making an album, someone else pays for that, so it's cheap to me. But running theme so far, but hopefully I won't be married and be like, darling, we need a divorce. Write another album or nothing, but that'd be really bad.
It's quite cold, to be honest.
Who's this? Who's speaking at the end? What's the vocal at the end that cuts?
That was my ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, so that's interesting, and I think it's super cool that you lift that in, obviously, from a sort of imagery point of view, because I love all that stuff. I love hearing things that revolve around music and not necessarily just tied to a structure. But the decision to keep, you know, your ex-girlfriend speaking at the end of the song is, like, so blunt and so straight up. Like, what the f*** was going through your mind? Like, anyone else who's just broken up with someone right now is, like, not on your wildest day would I do
that. Yeah, I know.
So there you go. An audio clip from Nora Fey's upcoming show, Please Break My Heart, showing tomorrow night and Valentine's night at Smock Alley. And I guess the timing is very decided there.
Yeah, it feels very appropriate in a way. For I think the piece is so pro and anti-Valentine's Day, so it ties into it all.
Yeah, so it's looking at it from both sides. Yeah. Who did we hear in the midst of that clip?
We had kind of Adele talking to Alan Carr and then Harry Styles talking to Zane Lowe. And I loved kind of mixing that with this kind of disco beat that my amazing sound designer Tien Lee made as well. But seeing how so many artists also talked about using kind of their real life experiences and using that as part of it, and almost knowingly having these experiences and seeing how they would turn into their art as well. So we know it as listeners and they know it as artists as well. So it's a funny line of seeing where does the kind of the work and the artist blur between the real life as well. So it's interesting seeing actually where does this happen? How is the work created as well? And how far do we go for content and for what you want to experience yourself?
And have you feelings on that, you know, how an artist does or doesn't exploit their own heartbreak? Because if there's heartbreak, there's somebody else potentially involved in this as well. So the artist goes, oh, well, thanks for breaking my heart. Yeah. Perhaps I broke yours, but now I'm going to use that as material. Is there an ethical concern, or is that way too serious?
I know, it's a funny one as well, because even in the kind of further on in the clip, there's like Taylor Swift and Little Mix talking about winning awards, and they thank their exes in it as well, knowingly that kind of period of their life helped kind of form something that they made as well. I think that's something I talk about in the piece as well, as to how you kind of mold something or mold an experience and how it can become something universal then as well with it. And somehow something so personal to you can be accessible then for so many people. It's just that kind of blend. I think I find that so fascinating.
Dolly Alderton, the writer Dolly Alderton, yes, I think is important within the show as well. Tell us a bit about her and how her work fits into Please Break My Heart.
I think I've always been obsessed with her writing as well. And there's no one better almost to write about love and heartbreak as her, in a way. Her book, Everything I Know About Love, I think it's almost my Bible almost in making. Mm-hmm. I kind of read it back every time I want to create something. But how she plays with kind of humor and silliness and some things, the kind of mundane, and making that magical, and all through this kind of romanticized lens as well. And we have that, I think, in the piece. I wear my school uniform and I like recreate my first breakup as well, while kind of Julie Andrews is playing. So all these kind of weird things coming together.
And did you speak to the
together.
Person involved in the first breakup about using that material?
It'll be a nice surprise for them as well. But no names, they'll be grand. It'll be a great image anyway, so we'll enjoy that.
Yeah, and they may recognise themselves, but you're not naming them, so that's fair enough. This is, I'm thinking of your piece, Ham, Sandwiches and Discipline, from a couple of years back. First of all, just remind us of that piece, which was a duet, in fact, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a duet that premiered actually at Seen and Heard Festival last year, and then we toured it through 2024 to Paris and Galway and Dublin Fringe most recently. And that was a duet about the world of the GAA, basically. Mm. Yeah.
So that duet and the world of GAA, does it link into the theme of romance in any way?
I mean, I feel like the GAA is almost a love letter to Irishness as well. So there's definitely that idea of kind of passion and commitment as well in kind of both of them. But it's been interesting kind of playing with the same tone and the kind of campness and comedy that we have in Ham Sandwiches, and that's kind of seemed to go down so well with that work. And now using it almost in a different sphere, but having that same kind of tone charging through it as well.
You also, you did have Ben Sullivan on stage with you during that, during Ham Sandwiches and Discipline, which was a duet, as I said.
Yeah.
Here you are now in a solo show.
I know,
How different an experience is that? What kind of pressure does it put on you?
Yeah, it definitely does feel quite different in a way. I think it's funny being in the studio then suddenly on your own after having kind of months spent with a person and kind of building something with them in a way. It's been kind of good and bad in different ways. I think I've been quite free almost in this less structure almost in how I make it. It's kind of because it's just me and me as the maker. Everywhere I go, I'm constantly kind of thinking of it in a way. It's kind of slowly kind of bubbling away with me all the time. Mm. I've been trying to kind of build a team around it with technicians or sound designers, or even Ben's helping out with tech tomorrow, just to get people so I don't feel so isolated, that it feels like there's a team making it if they're not on stage with me.
And is it a 20-minute show?
Yes.
Have you plans to develop that further or to lengthen it, or what is your thinking on that?
Yeah, it's I think Seen and Heard Festival is so great that you get to try out an idea with an audience as well and see what resonates. I think that's what we found with Ham Sandwiches last year, actually knowing what's working, what's not working then as well.
So did it start as quite a relatively short piece and then grow from that?
Yeah, we had it at 25 minutes this time last year, and then by taking it to Dublin Fringe Festival, it was at kind of 55 minutes. So it was like each time we did it, it grew. So I'm hoping that'll happen now with this piece as well. Actually seeing, because it takes a bit longer with just me being in as well at the different stages of it. So I'll see what works now, what happens, and how we can bring it on further then as well.
You did ask the question, why are all our favourite books, films, plays or songs charged with love and heartbreak? Have you got the answer after developing 20 minutes of the piece?
I think I'm definitely closer, and we're slowly getting there. But yeah, I'm understanding it a lot more now as well.
All right. Please Break My Heart is at Smock Alley, Dublin, 6:30 p.m. on the 13th and the 14th of February as part of the Seen and Heard Festival. Noreen Anlin Fay telling me about it this evening. For the details on seenandheard.ie. Lovely reactions to our interview earlier on with Candy State, and I have to say I was absolutely transfixed by her, and one of our texters transfixed by this interview. I'm parked outside the house, can't leave the car, enjoying every word from Candy, every note of her music, and the loving the rapport between the two of you, and really enjoyed your interview with Candy. Then second text from Mick J. So I thought I might go back. I was transfixed by her and by the album. So I'm going to finish up this evening with another little bit from the album. But before I do that, let me tell you that Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound. Leah Murphy researched this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I'll be back with you tomorrow night at 7. John Creedon will be with you after the news. But I'm going back to Candy Staten to finish up, and her sister, Maggie Peebles. There Will Be Peace at the Valley, from the album, which is called Back to My Roots.